All right, good morning, everyone. So let's begin. So what we're going to try to do today, Mir Tzah Hashem, is to finish off the Eretz. Right? I think that's what we still have a little bit of Eretz left over. So again, going back, we interrupted a bit with Gan Eden, but now we are back. So we made a detour to Gan Eden. Halavai. Right? But now we are back to Eretz. Okay, so just to reorient ourselves a little bit. So remember again, if you should have the source sheets, I think they were mistitled. They might actually say were they mistitled? They'll say the heavens on top? Yeah. Okay, so it says the heavens on top, but just look for the one that says Eretz Omeres. Should have a total of 10 sources on it. The left, first one being Parakshir, last one being the Radak. So just to reorient ourselves a little bit. So remember again, we saw that the Eretz said as follows. The Eretz quoted the Pasuk from Tilim, Le David Mizmar, La Shema Eretz Umlo'o, Tevel the Yoshve Va. So we got into the discussion regarding brachos and the concept that before a person makes a bracha, so ultimately again, the item belongs to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. After a person makes a bracha, before a person makes a bracha, the item belongs to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. After the bracha, the item belongs to the individual. We then saw the Rabbi Nachman in the Likutei Halachos, who explained that the entire essence of, you know, we are always using the example of fruit, but the entire essence of fruit is to serve as the ambassador of the Ribono Shel Olam. That through the fruit, I'm able to see the greatness of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So we discussed that in great depth. Then we saw the Gemara Maseches Yuma, which was number 5, that explained that really just as the fruit is the ambassador of the Ribono Shel Olam, meaning it's through the creations. And I think I mentioned, you know, yes. Yes, I'm sorry. Better? Yeah. Okay, thank you. So, I don't know if I mentioned this when we were dealing with Aris last time, but the Rambam discusses that this is not just the din by fruit. I think I did mention this. Right, the Rambam discusses in Hilchos Deos, the general concept, that if a person wants to come to an appreciation of the Ribono Shel Olam, the way to do that is simply through studying the natural world. Yeah, I did. I quote Rabbi Soloveitchik, quotes William James, through the starlit sky, one feels the breath of infinity upon the nape of their neck. It's a very beautiful. So this idea that through nature, you begin to see the awesomeness of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So then it turns out what Rabbi Nachman is doing is really taking this same idea of the Rambam, just turning it around a little bit. So whereas the Rambam understands that it is through nature that I see the gadlus habore, I see the greatness of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, all Rabbi Nachman is using a little bit of a different word. So therefore, because of that, the natural world are the ambassadors of the Ribono Shel Olam. Think about this. What's the job of an ambassador? To represent. That's the job, sorry. So the ambassador of the United States goes to another country. Their job is to represent the United States in any foreign country. So it turns out that, says Rabbi Nachman, everything in the natural world is an ambassador of the Ribono Shel Olam. Here in this world, to represent the Godless Habore to us. The Gemara Maseches Yuma said that just as the natural world are the ambassadors of HaKadosh Baruch Hu to us, it is our job to be the ambassadors of the Ribono Shel Olam to the rest of the world. This was the idea of V'yahavtas Hashem Elokecha, to love Hashem your God. The Gemara said an incredible definition. Remember again, what's the problem with that pasuk? V'yahavtas Hashem Elokecha? Not the problem, but the challenge. How can you legislate love? How can you demand that you love someone or something? It's impossible. You could legislate behaviors. You can't legislate emotions. And that's why the Gemara says, you're right. It doesn't mean to love HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It means that live your life in such a way that the Ribono Shel Olam becomes beloved in the eyes of others. Which is another way of saying, live a life of Kiddush Hashem. That when people see you, this is an incredible metric to establish for oneself. To live the kind of life where when someone sees me, they say, you know what, being a Jew is something special. Now, lav dafka, that means they're going to want that for themselves. That's fine. We're not a proselytizing religion. We're not interested in winning people over to our side. But the idea is that I look at myself as an ambassador of the Ribono Shel Olam. And the job of an ambassador is to represent his country of origin well. My country of origin is the Ribono Shel Olam. And as such, my job in this world, every day when I live my life, is to represent HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the most favorable light possible. How do you measure favorable light? That when people see me, and they see the way I behave, and they see the way I conduct themselves, they say, oh, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is good, Torah's good, mitzvos are good, because look at the product. Look at the result of engaging in a lifestyle such as that. So what I want to take your attention to now today is number six. So if you look at number six, Reb Tzadik HaKohen, Reb Tzadik of Lublin, another one of the great Hasidic masters, says something that I think is really quite amazing, kind of picking up on this same pasuk. Reb Tzadik writes, he says, Aval be'emes amru kvar amru, b'reish parakeitzan mevarchin, ksiv, la'ashem ha'aretz umlo'o, ksiv ha'shamayim shamayim la'ashem. So we spoke about this, right? So we spoke about the idea, la'ashem ha'aretz umlo'o, that everything, the earth and the heavens, belong to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And then I have another pasuk that says that the shamayim belongs to HaKadosh Baruch Hu via aretz nasan livnei adam. But that ultimately, again, the earth belongs to man. So which one is it? So remember again, how does the Gemara resolve it? Kan kodem bracha, kan la'achar bracha. The earth belongs to HaKadosh Baruch Hu before one makes a bracha, but the earth then belongs to man, right? Man then acquires possession after he makes the bracha. That's how the Gemara resolves it. So Reb Tzadik says something amazing. He says, Perush, Shabracha hu hakaras ha'adam, Shahakom nishal Hashem yisbarach. What's a bracha? This is really an incredibly yisodistic idea. What is a bracha? A bracha, says Reb Tzadik, is a statement that says, everything is from the Ribono Shel Olam. That's what it says. And by the way, when you look at brachos that way, then suddenly you understand that we have brachos when? Well, that's an open-ended question. But one of the interesting, you have brachos for every occasion, right? You have brachos for simchas, of a shechianu, or a tov hametiv, but you also have brachos like what? Dynamis. So an amazing, because what is the job of a bracha? The job of a bracha is a verbal articulation which highlights an ideological or theological fact that everything is from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. From my apple, to a birth, to a simcha, to a yomtiv, to a death. Everything is from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He goes on, he says, "Hu akara." It's such a profound... Now you understand, Reb Tzadik was not born into a Hasidic family. There's a difference in the writings of the Hasidic masters who were born into a life of Hasidus versus who came into it later on. Reb Tzadik was an Eli, was an outstanding Talmud Chacham, who came to Hasidus a little bit later on. He was a student of Rebbe of Ishbitz. Interestingly enough, Reb Tzadik's writings are very lumdish. In the world of Hasidus, very lumdish. And that's because he came to it really with a different type of thought and orientation. See, he writes over here, this idea that a bracha, this is an incredible definition. A bracha is hakaras ha'adam shakol me'ashem yisbarach. A bracha is the verbal articulation that all is from God. So watch this. So here's the line that took me in this piece of Reb Tzadik. V'kaasher ha'adam makir, she'en lo mishalo klum. What does that mean? V'kaasher ha'adam makir, she'en mishalo klum, rak hakol me'ashem yisbarach. What does that mean? When a person realizes, now look at the strength of his word. Makir she'en lo mishalo klum. Translate those words. Nothing is mine. Nothing is mine. Right? Remember again, Reb Tzadik just followed this progression. If a bracha is a verbal articulation that everything is from Hashem, and if you think about this for a moment, there's a bracha for everything, right? Think about this. There's a bracha for, not everything, but virtually everything, right? Think about this in just a moment. There's a bracha for when you eat. There's a bracha for using the bathroom. There's a bracha for reach. There's a bracha for re'iyah. There's a bracha for simcha. There's a bracha for everything. And sometimes the only things that we don't have a bracha for are because maybe a person is not in a physical state that they're able to recite a bracha. But there's a bracha for everything. So if you take Reb Tzadik's definition that the concept of a bracha is that hakol me'Hashem yisbarach, everything is from the Ribono Shel Olam. So if everything is from the Ribono Shel Olam, then the logical extension of that is she'en lo mishalo klum. I have nothing. Nothing is mine. Nothing is from me. Rak hakol me'Hashem yisbarach. Everything is from Hashem. Now here's the incredible idea. Once you have that mindset that everything is from Hashem and nothing is yours, then what? As via aras nasan livnei adam. So this is what is Reb Tzadik saying? Tell me what Rav Tzadik is saying. An incredible, incredible dynamic. Right. So it sounds so strange. The moment that I realize nothing is mine and everything comes from HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the moment that the Ribono Shel Olam conveys ownership of something to me. So on a very simple level, the moment I realize that the apple is not mine, yeah, I bought it, right? It's sitting in my refrigerator or I picked it off my tree. It's not mine. It's HaKadosh Baruch Hu's. The moment I recognize that it's not mine and it belongs to HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the moment that the Ribono Shel Olam conveys ownership of that object to me. And by the way, I'm using the apple is just our example. But if you plug this in, in any life event, that's the progression of a bracha. What is occurring now is not from me, it's from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But for the moment I make the bracha, what happens? What happens? The moment I make the bracha, what happens? So in the case of the apple, it becomes a... What about when a person makes a bracha of Dina Emes? What happens in that moment? What would you say, based on Rav Tzadik? What happens? What does it mean that the loss becomes mine? What would you say? I'm sorry? I'm empowering myself now to deal with it, to live with it, and to move on with it. You know, there's an interesting halacha in Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch says that in the case of death, a person is not allowed to say, I would give anything to change these circumstances. You're not allowed to make a statement like that. I wish I could change what happened, or I wish I could change. Why aren't you allowed to make a statement like that? I'm sorry? So it could be a lack of emunah, good. Although, interestingly enough, I'll point out to you something fascinating. Rabbi Soloveitchik points out that when a person loses a loved one, so before burial, they're in a state of aninos. When a person is an onin, they are exempt from nitzos aseh. They're exempt from all positive commandments. So there's two different approaches to why that is. So possibility one is osik b'mitzvah patur min ha-mitzvah. You're engaged in caring for the needs of the dead, and therefore you are exempted from all the mitzvahs. Rabbi Soloveitchik advances an incredible idea. He says, Chazal understood that the mourner may be angry at God. Which is understandable. A person loses a loved one, especially again, the more tragic the death, the more acute these circumstances could be. And Chazal did not want to force the Avel, or the Onein, to interact with HaKadosh Baruch Hu in an unnatural way. A person has a right to get angry with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. A person has a right. You can't stay angry at God, because staying angry at God, at the end of the day, hurts you. It hurts you. It takes away your opportunities for growth. But there's a recognition that sometimes people get angry at HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And amazingly enough, halacha almost gives you the space to be able to get angry. But then what does halacha do? Forces you to re-engage. Because the moment that at the end of the day, the kavura, the burial is done, aninos is over, avelos begins, and you're chayiv in all mitzvahs during avelos. So you can be upset and want to walk away for a little bit. You could disengage for a short amount of time because you feel wronged. But at the end of the day, you have to re-engage. So the Shulchan Aruch says, you're not allowed to say, if I could go ahead and change these circumstances, I would. It's a very simple reason why. Because it is a statement, it's a futile statement. You can't change what happened. Whatever happened, happened. So at the end of the day, to make a statement, I wish I could change these things, is using your emotional, mental, and sometimes physical energy in a way that's totally non-productive. So there are different stages of grieving, different models. They say there are five stages of grief. So one of the most important stages of grief is acceptance. A person accepts, this is my reality. This is my new life. I never thought this would be my life. I can't believe this has happened to me, but this is it. The moment you accept the reality is the moment you are then empowered to do something about it. You know, this happens all the time. Forget about death for just a moment. You see people in life who can't get over the fact that they've missed opportunities. We all miss opportunities in life, but some people, they can't get over the fact, oh, if I only would have taken that job, where I would have been in life right now. If I only invested in that stock, how much money I could have made. If I only would have paid more attention here or done this or done that. And people spend their lives lamenting their mistakes of the past. And you see people who literally, they can't get out of their past. They are just stuck reliving the mistakes over and over and over. And what do you get from obsessing over your past mistakes?
Nothing.
Nothing. And instead, what it does do is, it saps you of your energy, vitality, and drive to try to do better in the future. So if the Shulchan Aruch says, don't say things like you wish you could change it, because you can't change it. You can't, no matter how much you try. You could click your heels together from here until tomorrow. You can't change anything. What happened, happened. There is no going back. There is no reversing. So to say stuff like that and to put your energies into anticipatory desires of changing that which occurred is an exercise in futility and saps you of the energy you need to rebuild. So using this model, when you make a bracha of Diana MS, what happens? The loss has become yours. What does it mean the loss has become yours? According to Rabbi Tzadok, what does that mean? What have you done? You've accepted it. And when you accept it now, okay, this is my grief. This is my life. This is my situation. I would have never chosen it for myself. Never. But this is what I've got. It's going to have to figure out how to maximize. It says upside that that's what a bracha does. When you begin Baruch Atah, when you begin those words, it begins the acknowledgement, nothing is mine. Nothing is mine. I don't own it. I don't control it. Nothing is mine. And when you finish the bracha, the Ribbono Shel Olam says, okay, now that you've done that and acknowledged that, now I give it to you. Whether it's the apple, or whether it's the grief, or whether it's the simcha, these are now your circumstances that have become yours to do something with them alive. So Rav Tzadik goes on, he says something amazing. Okay, I don't think we have to do the rest of this. Rav Tzadik, fine. So I was very intrigued by this line. I'm going on a little bit of a detour, but we're going to come back to Parak Shira, tie it back. Very intrigued by this statement of Rabbi Tzadok, because that notion of she'eno mishalo klum, right? That you have nothing, you control nothing, I thought was a very jarring statement. Now, Rabbi Tzadok says that it's true, but it got me thinking a little bit. Is that really true? Is that true that I control nothing, that nothing is mine in this world? Because that's a very absolute statement. So take a look at number 7. I want to explore this a little bit with you. So there's an incredible Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. The Mishnah says, "Hu haya Omer." He used to say, "Lo alecha hamalacha ligmar." You are not responsible to finish the job. However, "Velo ata ben chorin libatal mimena." But you are also not free to go ahead and exempt yourself from it. So what's the takeaway message of the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos? Try your best. Try your best. That's the simple. Or say a little bit the meaning. What am I responsible for in life? Effort. One of the most incredible yisodos in Yiddishkeit. That the Ribono Shel Olam does not gauge success based on results. He gauges success based on... Isn't this... I have to tell you, Yiddishkeit has many beautiful and inspiring ideas and tenets. To me, this is probably one of the most important things in life. The notion that my success in this world and my success as a person is not based on the results of my actions, but is based on the amount of effort I expend, gives each of us the chizik to try, to push ourselves. Because the truth is, if you define success by results, then what activities will you engage in life? Think about this just a moment. If success is defined by results, then what projects will you take on in life?
Easy ones.
Right? Things for which you have... Because nobody wants to fail. I don't want to fail. No one wants to fail. So if that's it, if success is defined by results, so the truth is what ends up happening, and a lot of people approach life this way, set the bar very low. Meaning, no, don't push yourself too hard because there's a risk of failure. Nobody wants to fail, so only take on things that you could go ahead and you could be almost assured of success. But if there's a strong possibility of failure, better not to take it on. But if you live your life understanding that in the Ribono Shel Olam's eyes, the metric of success is not results, but rather it's effort, suddenly again, that empowers you to take on all kinds of things, even if you are not guaranteed of success. By the way, who is the first person who taught us this yisod? about not being afraid to try to take on things that seem to be beyond your ability to succeed at? I'm sorry? Avram. Avram definitely did it. That's absolutely true. Who else? I heard. I'm sorry? Vasya. Where do you see it by Vitya? Where do you see it? Oh, the Lublina Rav mentions this idea. He asked such a fascinating question, right? Batishlach es hamasa, right? Basparo, bitya, basya, however you pronounce it. Right? She extends her hand, and Rashi says a miracle occurred. The shtarvev yada, her hand extended, and she reached the little basket of Moshe Rabbeinu. So Rav Meir Shapir of Lublin, you heard of Lublin Rav, right? Rav Meir Shapir of Lublin was the Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshiva Schachme Lublin. He himself was a chart cover chassid as well, the originator, the founder of Daf Yomi, an individual who, although he lived, he died, I think at the age of 49, he passed away, didn't have children, but the imprint, the legacy he left was so profound. So Lublin Rav asks a simple question. He says, I don't understand. In general, if you're reaching out to something, when do you reach out to your arm? When do you reach out your arm? So if I need a chair from the back of the room, am I reaching out my arm? No, it's not shayach. In other words, you reach out your arm. So like if I want to reach the edge of that partition, okay, you know, maybe if I stretch a little bit. You reach out your arm when something is in realistic grasp. But if something is so far away, I don't reach out my arm for the chair at the end of the room. It doesn't make any sense. So yes, basparo. Why are you reaching? I mean, if you need a miracle to extend your arm that far, that means that basket was not within your realm of reach. If it wasn't within your realm of reach, then why do you even bother extending your arm? It says Lublin Rav, because this is what Basia was teaching us, that sometimes in life you have to extend your arm, even though there's no real possible way that you're going to be able to reach the thing that you desire. But sometimes in life, you just saw, Batya sees, right? Bitya sees a basket, a baby floating in the Nile. For some reason, she has compassion on this baby. And she says, you know what? I don't know. I can't reach it. But I have to try. Where else do we see this concept? Where else? Another story in Chumash, a dramatic story, where somebody gives this same idea. Just got to try. I'm sorry? Excellent. By where? By Yom Suf, good, excellent. Where else do you see it? Where else do you see? So Nachshon demonstrates it actually. Where else do you see it stated? The Pasuk, who said, Alo na'ale v'arashnu osa ki achal nuchala? Close. Right? It was Kalev. Right? Alo na'ale. Right, so what happens? The miraculum come back. Now, by the way, understand the Piaget's Nachir. Kolam is Kamush Pir Hashem Yikom Domo writes about this in Parsha Shlach in Tav Shin in the year 1939 when he gave this drush in the Warsaw Ghetto. He asks this question. He says, "I don't understand. The miraculum come back and they deliver a report." Now, understand. I think I mentioned this in our last class. You know, a lot of times when we look at certain people in Chumash. So we look at them through the lens of how the story ends, right? So we spoke about this, right? Esav Zarasha, Yishmael Zarasha, they didn't start out Rishon. They didn't start out Rishon. We look back at the end of their life and we project back at the beginning of the story. The Meraglim were good men. They were good men. They were good men who did not intend to sin. They were good men who somehow just profoundly lost their way. So remember, they come back from the reconnaissance mission. And what happens? What's the report they give? Anyone remember? What do they say about the land? People are giants. What else do they say? Fortified cities, right? They are reporting on facts. They give facts. The one piece of subjective information is they say, that they say we're like grasshoppers in their eyes. They project it. They project it. Okay, fine. But everything else is fact. So comes along Kalev. What does Kalev say? He silences everyone. Vayas Kalev Esa'am. And what does he say? Alo na'ale, let's go. V'arashnu osa, let's inherit the land. Ki achol nuchala. Let's go ahead, because we could do this. And what's the Piaget's question? What's the Piaget's, if you were the, what's the question?
We can't come.
What do you mean we can? What do you, see, if Kalev would have come along and said, listen, it's true it's fortified cities, but I found an underground tunnel. It's true that the people are giants and very strong, but I found their Achilles heel. So the Meraglim brought up legitimate points. If you want to argue on the Raglim, that's fine. Go right ahead. But advance an argument or advance a counter-argument. But instead, what does Khalid give? You know what you call that? What did Khalid give? Khalid gave like a rah-rah speech. Like, Divrei Chizk, you can do it. You can do it. You can do it. Okay, thank you. How am I going to do it? And the Piaget says this incredible essay. When you understand who he was talking to in 1939 in the Warsaw Ghetto, what Khalid was saying is, you know, I don't have an answer. I don't know how we overcome the fortified cities. And I don't know how we overcome the giants. But I have to tell you, we have to do it. We have to do it. Sometimes in life, you just have to say, this has to get done. This is incredibly important because sometimes there are things I know I have to do, but I don't know how I'm going to do it. And if I start, bless you, and if I start going in and trying to figure out, well, what about this problem, that problem? Sometimes you just have to start, I got to do it. One way or another, it's got to get done. I have to accomplish. So Khalid was saying back, we could make this a conversation about the problems and about the challenges. And the truth is, I don't have an answer for all those things because they are legitimate issues. But all I can tell you is, we've got to get it done. All I can tell you is that we have to do the same thing that Basparo did. That Basparo did not so long ago. Sometimes you just have to reach out your arm. Sometimes I know I can't reach the chair, but I know I have to get the chair. So some way, somehow, I just have to begin the process and hope that somewhere along the way, I'm going to figure it out. So amazingly enough, the Mishnah is telling us, Lo alech hamalach haligmar. The Ribono shel Olam does not determine success by results, but by effort. Yes. It's true. Meaning, which compounds the sadness of the Meraglim story, right? They were living l'mala min ha-teva to begin with. You're right. Which that's part of the chit ha-Meraglim was that it's true. You're coming back with good tainus, substantive tainus. But look what's happening every day around you. There's an Eish, there's an Anan, there's Man, there's Kriyas Yamsuf, there's Milchama Samalik, there's all this stuff. You're right. That's the tragedy of it, that they couldn't even realize that even if the Meraglim were right about every single thing, the Ribon Shalom is fighting this war for us. You're saying good. Yes.
Sorry, I missed. Who said this?
Rav Klonimus Kalmish Shapira, the Piagetzna Rebbe. He says a sefer called Ish Kodesh. Did we ever speak about the Piagetzna? I think we mentioned it in passing. Right, the Piagetzna was Piagetzna is a small town in Poland outside of Warsaw. It's still there. I mean, there's nothing there now. The Rebbe's house actually is there. The Rebbe's house is there. There's a mikveh inside the Rebbe's house as well. Some Polish family is living there now. But Lamaisa, the Piagetzna, and then the Piagetzna was put in the Warsaw Ghetto, and he became like the unofficial Rav of the Warsaw Ghetto. So he used to deliver drushas every single Shabbos when circumstances permitted. After Shabbos, someone recorded them. It's a little bit of a historical debate if the Rebbe wrote them or if a Gabbai wrote them down. And the Rebbe, sensing that he would not survive the war, had the drushas buried in a milk canister in the ghetto. And after the war, when they were clearing the rubble from the ghetto, so was a non-Jewish Pole. A Pole discovered the canister, you know, hashkacha, that he didn't just throw it away. He saw that it was some kind of Jewish writing on it, an inscription. They sent it to Eretz Yisrael. There was a cousin of the Piagetzna who lived in Eretz Yisrael, and they published it under Ish Kodesh. It's incredible, incredible, incredible work. The Divrei Torah themselves are incredible, but there's a book now that came out by a professor, Henry Abramson. I forgot the title of it. I think it's called I forgot the name of it, but it's a historical work on the Ish Kodesh. And what he did is he fills in what was happening historically around each of the drushas. So now, and you see, when you understand what was happening, it gives you a greater appreciation of what the Rebbe was saying. Because the Rebbe's drushas were often a response to what was happening in the ghetto at that time. So it's quite dramatic. So if you take a look at number 8, so let's explore this concept a little bit, because it's incredibly important, and I think one of the greatest yisodos of life. So this is a perish on Pirkei Avos called the Perishman on Pirkei Avos from Rav Menachem Nochum Friedman, who is the Shtefen Eshter Rebbe. So who is the Shtefen Eshter Rebbe? So going back, one of the greatest Hasidic personalities was a man by Rabbi Yisrael of Rizhin, simply known as the Rizhiner. The Rizhiner was an exceptional personality. The Rizhiner was a grandson of the Maggid of Mezrich. And the Rishner felt that one of the saddest things that had happened to the Jewish people was the fact that we had forgotten that we are Malchus. Because of persecution and because of downtroddenness, we had just forgotten that we were truly royalty. And so the Rishner felt an incredible need to restore a sense of Malchus, a sense of grandeur, back to Klal Yisrael. So it means that the Rishner lived in a magnificent palatial estate. He had a gold carriage that was pulled by white horses. The buttons of his bekesha were gold. He was also directed, he had a yichus directly back to David HaMelech. So there's an element of Malchus. So the Rishner, what people didn't know about the Rishner is that it was really all for show. He wanted the Jewish people to be able to look at once again what Malchus looked like. But the Rishner himself was very austere, but he hid it from his Hasidim. The way the Hasidim discovered who their Rebbe really was, it's actually incredible, is one Masei Shabbos, they were saying Kiddush Levana in the winter, and they noticed that in the snow where the Rishner was standing, it was red. It was red after Kiddush Levana. And they didn't understand what had happened until they discovered that their Rebbe did not have soles on his shoes. To keep himself humble in the midst of all of this, and to really, really not wanting to get hana from any of these things, but wanting it to be about Klal Yisrael. Can you imagine this? He had gold buttons on his bekesha, lived in a palatial estate, had a gold carriage pulled by white horses, but yet didn't have soles on his shoes. So the bottom of his foot got stuck to the snow by Kiddush Levana. That was the blood, and that's how they realized. So the Rishner had a number of sons, each of them founding their own dynasties. One of the dynasties was Stefan Esht. So this son, Rab Menachem Nachum, was an incredible Talmud Chacham, but also an incredible scholar. Now, I don't know where he got his worldly knowledge from. I have no idea. I can't imagine he actually attended university, because in those times it just wasn't really done. But he's brilliant. You'll see from his Perushim Pirkei Avos, it's one of the most dramatic Perushim, because it brings in knowledge from everywhere. So look what he writes in number 8. So the Stefan Esht explains this idea. What does it mean? Lo alecha malacha ligmar viata ben chorni batmi. Let's look what the Rebbe writes. He says, paragraph A, 8A. He's Mishnah Yotes. Who ya Omer ad matan schar shal tzadik. Fine. Lo alecha malacha ligmar viata ben chorni batmi. So it is not upon you to finish the job, but you are not also free. You are not just because you can't finish it doesn't mean you are exempted from drunks. Look what he writes. Kiba poel. This is incredible. Kiba poel. Yesh anoshim. Listen, there's some pieces of Torah that I'm telling you forever change your life. This is one of them. He says, ki bepoel yesh anoshim, shelem osem es hatov. There are some people, ultimately, again, who don't do good things. Now, he's not talking about people who sin. People who don't engage in positive, dynamic activity. Why? Yan, he misantzim tavid losos es hatov yoser. How would you translate this phrase? There are some people who don't engage in tov because they're so fixated on the tov yoser. Anyone know what that means? Some people who don't engage in good things because they are on the quest for perfection. I don't want to do something good. I'm a perfectionist. I only do things in a perfect way. Kilomar, hey, misamtsim umishtadlin ligumar salacha kula. So in their eyes, if they're going to take something on in life, there almost has to be a guaranteed success. Perfection. If I'm good, I'm a perfectionist. If I'm going to do something, it has to get done perfectly. So what happens when a perfectionist is faced with an opportunity? So if you're a perfectionist and you're faced with an opportunity, what's the first thing you ask yourself? Perfectionist faced with opportunity. What's the first question? Can I finish this? Can I finish this? Because what is the point of starting something that can't be finished? Right? What's the point of beginning something that I don't know with 100% certainty that I could finish off to perfection? So a perfectionist is offered an opportunity. The first question is, can I perfectly perform it? And if the answer is no, then what? Don't try. If I don't know that I can absolutely perfectly finish the particular task, there is no point in trying, no point in doing things halfway. He looks what he writes, Mashal Tsarfati, this is like a French adage, Hatov Yoser Sonu, Sone, I'm sorry, Hatov Yoser, Sone es hatov. Hatov yoser sone es hatov. How would you translate that in English? Excellent. Perfect is the enemy of the good. Who first said, perfect is the enemy of the good? It was the French writer, novelist, Voltaire. Voltaire was the one who came up with this phrase, the perfect is the enemy of the good. So I'm just pointing out that Stefan Eschter is quoting Voltaire, which is not every day that you find a Hasidic Rebbe quoting a French writer. That's what I'm saying. The knowledge is quite, I don't know where he got it from, but the knowledge is quite astounding. The perfect is the enemy of the good. He says, Vizos ve'emes, turn the page, paragraph B, Vizos ve'emes, Vizos ve'emes, Taru, Lanu Chazal va'amru. So listen to this. Chazal gave expression to this when they said the following. They said, Hatipesh hu nichnas labeis hamedrash. Listen to this mashal. A foolish person, now the person is not foolish at the outset. You're going to see why he's being called foolish. The tipesh walks into the beis hamedrash. Vera, osan oskim v'tor. What does he see in the beis hamedrash? He sees people learning. For hu amr lahem, heich adam lomed Torah tchila. So he sees people learning. Now, what the mashal points out is he sees people learning on a very advanced level. So he goes over to one of the people in the basement and says, tell me, I haven't learned Torah before. Where do I start? I'd like to be able to learn on the level that all of you are learning. Where do you start? And so they tell him, Omrim lo, t'chila korbim megillah, v'achar kach b'sefer, v'achar kach b'nevim, v'achar kach b'ksuvim, mishu gomer es ha-mikra, shoran es ha-talmud, v'achar kach b'agodos. So they begin to tell him, you start with Chumash, then you go to Navi, then you go to Ksuvim, then you go to Mishnah, then you go to Halacha, then you go to Gemara, then you go to Agarata, then you go to Rishonim, then you go to Achronim, and you learn and you learn and you learn. So what happens? The guy hears this and he says, Kevin Sheshomeakach, Omar Belimo, a Mose Ani Elamed Kozos. And the guy hears this and what does he say to himself? What does he say to himself? I don't have time for all this. I don't have time for all this. I understand the process, but I don't have time. So remember again, what is he asking? So he's asking, how do I become a great Talmud Chacham? You want to become a great Talmud Chacham? You have to start from the beginning. You have to start from Chumash, from Aleph Beis, and keep working your way up. And the guy says, oh, that's a lot of work. I don't think I have time to do all of that. And so what does he decide? What does Bechazra min Hashar? And ultimately, again, he walks away. Now, why does this individual walk away? Why does he walk away? He's overwhelmed. But ultimately, again, why? Why does he walk away? What did he want to accomplish? Right. I want to be perfect. I want to be the greatest Talmud Chacham. So I just heard what it takes to become the greatest Talmud Chacham. And the truth is, I don't have time for that. Like, is there a Cliff Notes? You know, maybe I could clep it. You know, maybe there's a summer course. You know, is there some way for me to go ahead and do that? I don't have time for all of this stuff. And if I can't be the greatest Talmud Chacham, then what is the value of beginning the process? The perfect is the enemy of the good. Not everybody is the greatest Talmid Chachamim. In fact, most people are not Talmidei Chachamim. And most people never rise to the level of Talmidei Chachamim. But so maybe they're not perfect. Maybe they're not perfect. Most of the Chachamim are not perfect either. Maybe they're not perfect. But you can be good. But you can be great. But this individual, this quote-unquote perfectionist, says, no. Either I'm perfect or bust, right? Either I aim for perfection or there's no point in doing anything. So if I can't be the perfect Talmud Chacham, I can't be the head of the class, I can't be the Gadol Hador, then what is the point of trying any of this? He goes on, he says, HaTipesh HaZeh Rotzeh Dafka Lilmot Kol HaTorah Kula Regalachos. This fool wants Kol HaTorah Kula. However, v'chivun sheroshi efshadah, but once he sees that it's not really possible, or that it's possible, but it's going to take an incredible investment of time, and he doesn't have that time, he's not satisfied, ultimately, again, with doing something less. V'rak ligmara samalacha kalu shifa. So, rather, again, once he realizes that all he wants to do, ultimately, again, is to go ahead and learn Kol HaTorah Kula, but he can't do it, he's not interested. V'ros Kizosi lemala miyachaloso chazer min hashar. Ultimately, again, when he begins to see that at the end of the day, he can't accomplish that which he sets out to do, then he just simply decides to walk away. V'cheilo pam achas yisrachik kishabam manachnu lidrosh meiza asher davar shevetzdaka. So again, the Rebbe goes on and he gives other examples of this. Sometimes you go to a rich person, you ask for tzedakah. The kasher misarim anachnu lefanav chashivas adavar Azmiyatu Yavoli de Hislavus. Umrof Hislavus wrote to Dafka Ligmar Samalocha Kula. Aba Kasher Yashva Daitra Lav Roshekvar Hirbelafanov, Vyashra Lasos Kilava Ligmar Samalocha Asmo. See, he just gives multiple examples. What the Stefan Eshter explains is so profound, which is the worst thing you could possibly be in life is a perfectionist. And I know that sounds strange, because people often say, I'm a perfectionist, almost like as if it's an accomplishment. It's not an accomplishment. It's an impediment and it's a handicap. Because perfectionists generally, you know what perfectionists really are? Right? Someone's a perfectionist. What are they really? I'm sorry? Say a little bit louder.
They're scared.
They're really insecure. They're really insecure. Because what the perfectionist really says is, I don't do anything that I'm not guaranteed success. I don't do anything without being absolutely sure that I could accomplish it. That's insecurity. Insecure people only do things that they're good at. Insecure people only do things that they know that they can handle. But you know what? Nothing ever happens because of insecure people. If Basia was an insecure person, we wouldn't be here. Right? And if Kali was an insecure person, then ultimately, again, we would have never gone into Eretz Yisrael. And even if Avraham Avinu was an insecure person, he would have never followed Lech Lecha. At the end of the day, being a perfectionist, says the Stefan Eshter, is the worst possible nida the Jew could possess. Because then you lose out on so much good in life in the pursuit of the perfect. The pursuit of perfection. See, understand, there's something even deeper here. That really also what perfectionism does is being a perfectionist allows you to hide behind your perfectionism. Right? Because if I'm a perfectionist, that's a p'tur. Suddenly again, I have an exemption. What do I have an exemption from? From what? What am I exempted from? Right, from trying anything that seems too challenging. No, I'm a perfectionist. I have to tell you something. I have this conversation all the time with people. Right, I have this conversation. We're trying to get people to come and learn or to commit. You know, I hear this all the time. We have a daf yomi share. Say, you know, come learn the daf. I can't. If I make a commitment, I really got to be solid. I'm like, wow, you know, I yearn for that my whole life. I try to be solid in my commitments. I have yet to be perfect in any one commitment in life. I'm not a perfect husband. I'm not a perfect father. I'm not a perfect Jew. I'm not a perfect human being. So the truth is, if you're going to go out and go be a perfectionist, better don't get married, right? And don't have children. And the truth is, you probably have to give up your Yiddishkeit as well, because like I said, it's impossible to be a perfectionist in any area in life. But we hide behind perfectionism. Because saying I'm a perfectionist it sounds so much better than saying I'm scared of failure. And saying I'm a perfectionist sounds so much better than saying I'm just personally insecure. Right? Saying a perfectionist, like, oh, I'm a perfectionist. That sounds like such a maila. When in fact it is, says the Stefan Eshter, the greatest chisaron. Because the perfect becomes the enemy of the good, as Voltaire said. Because in the quest of perfection, you miss out on all of the other incredible things in life. And that's what the Mishnah is saying. Lo alecha hamalacha ligmor. Don't be a perfectionist in life. Your job is not to be perfect. Your job is not to achieve perfect results. Your job is to stretch out your hand. Your job is alon na'ale v'yarash nozo ki'achon nuchala, to figure it out. That's your job. You don't have to be a perfectionist. The HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't want us to be a perfectionist, because perfectionists don't get anything done. This is the greatest yesod in life. Perfectionists accomplish virtually nothing. And the stuff they do accomplish, no one really cares about. And it doesn't really make such a big difference. There is only one perfectionist in this world, and that is... Trick question. Even at Kodesh Baruch Hu, Kodesh Baruch Hu Ba'atzmo is a perfectionist. But does he present as a perfectionist?
No.
And that's by design. Where's the first time that we see at Kodesh Baruch Hu goes out of his way to model himself as an imperfectionist? Where does he do that? Excellent. Who said that? Excellent. Right? Eitz Priyo Sepri. Right? Rashi HaKodesh says the original Bria was fruit trees which produce fruit. Tam Eitz Kepirio. And what does the Torah say? Eitz oseh pri. And Rashi HaKadosh says, oh, you see, the earth didn't comply. The tree tastes like a tree, I assume, right? And the fruit tastes like a fruit. So what happened? So the Maharal and Gur Aryeh says, I don't understand. How could the earth not comply with HaKadosh Baruch Hu? How could the earth not comply with the Ribono Shel Olam? The earth doesn't have Bechira. So the Maharal, the Ramchal, echoes this also basic idea in Derech Hashem as well, which is this concept that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, when in the original Bria, was going to create something perfect, right? Fruit that tastes like fruit and trees that taste like fruit is like equilibrium, it's perfection. Everything is sweet. And then HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, no, no, there's no perfection in this world. Because if I create something perfect in this world, then people will think that perfection is a goal, that perfection is something I aspire to. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, of course, I am perfect and I could create something perfect, but I choose not to. I choose to only create things that are imperfect in order that man understands that his quest in life is never for perfection. His quest in life is for good. And if you're a bit more ambitious, your quest in life is for great. But your quest in life is never for perfection. For one simple reason, says Voltaire, says the Stefan Eshter, that at the end of the day, perfect is the enemy of the good. All right, we'll stop over here for today. We're going to spend one more class on the Aretz. We're going to take this Yidin and Emirat Hashem, tie it back to Perek Shira, and we'll close out Aretz and Emirat Hashem on Monday.